Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
at... An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a Friday, and it kind of feels like the unofficial, official beginning of summer, even though that doesn't occur until June 20th or so. It just feels like it's
nice out there today. And it is Party Friday.
Party Friday.
So a perfect day for Party Friday. Chuck and the Merry Band are meeting later this afternoon, concocting more schemes.
Conspiring against the welfare of the people of Cotton.
No, conspiring against the establishment, yes. Diablos and rhinos. So
Diablos, yes.
So you can sleep safely tonight and go on about your Party Friday, knowing that Chuck and the Merry Band, they're men and women, have things under control. Hey, coming up in about 15 minutes, we're going to have Mark Poff. You guys all know who he is. Former El Paso County Sheriff Deputy. We have been covering or following a story for years now. There's murder, mayhem, corruption, cover up, and you all
prison gangs,
you name
white supremacist groups,
all the stuff in there. But you won't believe the prosecutorial misconduct that's alleged in a new lawsuit. So we'll talk about that. But want to start out about, so today was Rev's last Friday of fourth grade. He's out of school next week. The kids in his school are still wearing masks. We got an email from some of the clubs and places we go to saying, okay, so like no one else has to wear masks. The only people left having to wear masks in the country are little kids. Little kids, even though we know that all the hospitalization studies were fraudulent, right? Little kids, all the kids that were in the hospital with COVID. Hardly any of them from COVID. The little kids don't die. They can't get COVID, or if they do, the symptoms are mild to nothing. If they do get it, the viral load is so low, they're not transmitting it to anybody. And they, not only that, but they can't even get the vaccine. If you're under 12, you can't get the vaccine.
Well, we don't endanger the teachers, all of which have been vaccinated.
Right.
And so who are we protecting?
I mean, they don't even pretend anymore. The freak show of the CDC, the Colorado Health Department, and Dr. Fauci.
The evil Dr. Fauci.
Right. They don't even pretend to have a reason for the kids to still be vaccinated or to still have to wear masks. They just say, you still have to wear masks. I'm like, you know, not that they listen to the show, but you know what?
They do.
They need to come out and they need to just say, okay, look, we overlooked this whole thing about kids. You're right. The kids don't actually need to wear masks either. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. The kids can't get vaccinated. And I got a question. What parent would give their 5-month-old an untested experimental vaccine anyway?
Lefties.
All right. That's a good point. There are a lot of parents out there. And so now you're putting some of these poor kids. I don't know what the deal is. Iowa, my home state, has a new bill that bars cities and counties from forcing businesses to adopt mask mandate policies and from enforcing mask mandates on school kids. Now, that'll never happen in Colorado, of course, because of the progressive left that controls the state. But we need something like that. They need to make it clear that the kids don't need to wear masks. The rest of us aren't wearing masks.
Torture our children.
Right.
Well, the best of America.
And what's wrong?
Well, because they want them to be obedient little things to their whims and dictates and sickness.
It's just insanity. You know, we have a time so we could, Fox this morning had an interview with their, their health contributor, Dr. Nicole Sapphire. And here's what she had about it, had to say about it. Thomas, if you could play that, please.
Children are positive for the virus. They have a very mild disease course, if any symptoms whatsoever. And you have to remember, Ainsley, we dealt with this a little bit last summer where they were talking about inflating hospitalization and death counts for people, even adults. And, you know, we have to be careful because there is a perceived risk, and that is what a lot of these restrictions are based upon. But it is prudent that we get this risk right, as we know that we have harmed our children and adults when it comes to a lot of these restrictions. So this just, again, adds to that growing data that the risk to children is very low. And while more and more adults, young adults and adolescents continue to get vaccinated, and our percent positivity of tests have now hit an all-time low of about 2.7%, it's time to allow our children to get back to that level of normal life, knowing that they are not a risk to society and the risk of COVID-19 to them is negligible.
That's the problem with these studies. They inflate the numbers, and then
our experts make decisions for our children based on those numbers. And then we find out months later or a year later, all of that was not necessarily true. Most of those kids that were still testing positive but did not have any symptoms were in the hospital for surgeries, cancer treatment, urologic issues, psychiatric issues. Thank you so much, Dr. Sapphire, for being on.
So now we all know, okay, the studies are coming out now and they are clearing up the numbers. So we know the kids aren't at risk. So, but have they said, okay, you know what, kids, you actually don't have to wear a mask now?
Well, no, but you do have something that is at risk. You know, our teachers have been able to go to Puerto Rico, down to the beaches. Do you realize, Julie, that they are facing having to go to work this next fall? I mean, as hard as that is to believe, as scary as that is to believe, and I think we need to figure out something to relieve them, get them down to a 2-day.
Although I will say, not the teachers at our son's school, they've been great. Yes. My only concern is I think we have to take the hamster for the summer. I mean, you need to get on that. I know.
No, you guys may say. We're not taking the hamster for the summer.
That's my only concern.
You on that one. Dr. Mayo can have the hamster for the summer.
Here's the thing, though, that I think may be happening, because I've been seeing more and more progressive nut jobs say, oh, well, since all the kids still have to wear their masks, you parents should still wear your mask too so the kids don't feel bad.
Yeah,
so
they don't feel idiotic. They're sitting there going, why am I wearing a mask?
Right.
All you jerks don't wear a mask.
No,
and the liberal parents feel guilty about that, of course.
Well, yeah.
And to relieve that, they'll wear a mask. So the same
in solidarity with the kids. Now, no one has the same solution, which is, I know, let's not have the kids wear a mask, right?
No.
Instead, it's like, no, we know the kids don't have to wear a mask. There's this weird little loophole that we haven't addressed. Rather than just say, okay, no, the kids don't have to wear a mask, they're saying, okay, well, since the kids still have to wear a mask, all of you parents better wear a mask so the kids don't feel bad. My advice to you parents is just take the mask, stick it in your pocket,
stick it
in the shredder.
Yeah.
No, not there. That sounds like a fourth grader.
Still there mentally anyway.
Well, yeah. I mean, so I think as parents, we all need to stand up. You know, it's
stand up for the children.
Stand up. And, you know, I'll tell just a quick story because I think people are ready for this.
Oh,
I was walking into a big box store yesterday, and the mask sign was gone. So I've been like, hey, look, I'm not wearing my mask anymore. And if it's a business that requires it, I leave. And hardly any businesses require it anymore, actually. And so I was going in, and there was an elderly gentleman walking in with me. And he said, well, you're going to wear your mask. And he said, and I said, no, I'm not. And I said, I think it's better to, you know, beg for permission or beg for forgiveness and ask for permission. And he was cute. He goes, well, I'm more of the cowardly type and I don't want to get yelled at. So I said, I'm going to see what happens to you. So I was walking around the store and I saw him and he was like, has anybody yelled at you? And I said, no.
Yep.
And he goes, okay. And he took his mask off.
I liberated a fellow human being.
And I think that's all of our jobs, right? Because I'm like, Rev's not wearing a mask. It's, you know, I think if I have to say, he looks 12, so maybe say Rev's vaccinated. No,
he's
vaccinated.
He's a midget.
Yeah, we'll just say he's a cisgender something or other. So he doesn't have to wear a mask. But I think, though, it's important that all of us continue to not wear our masks, to take them off, and to protest our kids.
And also, it's your job to mock and belittle anybody you see out on the streets wearing a mask. Because Joe Biden said you'd be kind. Were they kind when you didn't wear a mask?
Right.
And you didn't have to. No, they're incredibly vicious. So.
Right. Well, that's why that gentleman, he was saying, I don't want to get yelled at, right? I mean, that's what people are afraid of, right? Everybody's afraid they're going to get yelled at. But I think restaurants are opening up, places are opening up. Downtown Denver is like, yeah, we're probably still screwed because we have all these homeless camps all over the place. So, well, you know, but they're like, they're going to try to get people to live downtown. I'm like,
a lot of people living downtown. More homeless will be coming in all summer long.
Exactly.
Exactly.
One other topic briefly before we get to Mark, this January 6th commission. I mean, to me, it's like Russia, Russia, Russia. What do you make of that?
Oh, I think it'll be fair. Everything that Nancy Pelosi and the Congress do is fair, standing bipartisan and everything else.
And look at the truth.
It's just a joke and they're vicious, amoral degenerates.
I think, though, that it could backfire because there's plenty of evidence that
they're not going to let it come out. They're not going to let those witnesses testify. Now, did you watch the Russian collusion hearings
and so forth?
I mean,
but I also don't think people are paying attention anymore. This is their attempt, I think, to continue to blast Trump supporters and people like that. But a lot of people have moved on. They even had Jen Psaki saying officers died. I mean, they just flat out lie. No officers died. No officers were even
injured.
One died of a heart attack, right?
Yeah.
And they did, of course, shoot and kill a Trump supporter.
Well, that doesn't count.
No, that doesn't count. So it's like insanity. So, Should we go to Mark? I see he's
no,
here.
No, we're not going to let him in.
No, we're going to let him in. So Mark Poff is a former El Paso County Sheriff investigator. We've had him back when we were on the radio. I had him on TV when I was working at Fox 31. He's all over the place. He's been on Peter's show a lot. He is one of the former investigators who was willing to talk about all of the evidence that indicated that a prison gang was responsible for the murder of Tom Clements, the Department of Corrections prison chief in 2013. Of course, nobody's ever been arrested. Nobody's ever been charged. The same people, there's also evidence, killed another DA, although it was a mistaken DA, and they would kill a pizza delivery guy. I mean, three murders, okay, that could be solved. There's plenty of evidence to have solved them. And people like the corrupt John Hickenlooper administration, the corrupt Dan May DA down in El Paso County, the corrupt sheriff there, Bill Elder, all of them, for a variety of their own personal reasons, I think it's fair to say, have conspired to keep the truth from coming out about that. They'd rather have no justice than anything that might possibly make them look bad.
Well, the question is, what's more outrageous? The fact that the murders of three people have never been solved, nor do they attempt to solve them, or was it the attempt to go after totally innocent people
right.
for non-existent crimes perpetuated by the CBI and the 18th Judicial District in conjunction with whatever district the El Paso is in?
Right.
I'm more outraged by the latter. I mean, you know, the 211 gang, they've kind
of... I think I have plenty of outrage for both. And that brings us in to Mark Poff. Mark Poff worked with John St. Augustine. He was another investigator at the El Paso County Sheriff's Department, who also, when asked, was speaking publicly about some of the evidence that was involved in this case. But also, Mark, why don't you kind of briefly outline the lawsuit that he has filed? And there have been some very interesting developments and emails and admissions going on in that case lately.
Yeah, so to kind of set the table, you know, back in March of 2013, Tom Clements was murdered. I worked on the investigation, just like other detectives down with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. And this is kind of important to set it all up. John St. Augustine was in charge of the entire investigation. So you don't have the sheriff. I mean, the sheriff is a supervisor.
Right.
Then you go down the chain until you reach somebody. It's like your job is to oversee the entire investigation. And that's what John St. Augustine did in this investigation. And it's important to know that CBI sent two vans to come down to start the investigation into the Tom Clements murder. And then they called and said, hey, you know, we've sent down two vans. We're going to take over the investigation. And Sheriff Makita and John St. Augustine said, no, time out. We're good. You can turn your vans around. And so CBI from way back, because you got to understand why CBI hates Sheriff Terry Makita and why they hate John St. Augustine. It's because they wouldn't let them have the Tom Clements homicide. In fact, they tried to take it over a few times.
Right.
They tried to get additional evidence for their own prosecution because of the person who provided Evan Ebel the gun that killed Tom Clements. And they wouldn't give him the whole case file, because they knew there was a leak and they didn't want information getting out. So you have to know that, just kind of going back, that in the Tom Clements homicide, then going forward.
Wait, let me interrupt 1 second there. Just one other thing that needs to be explained. So Terry Makita was a Republican, and he's independently elected. The CBI works for John Hickenlooper, who was then governor. Right. John Hickenlooper had a lot to do with why this case never got. I mean, so I personally think that John Hickenlooper and his staff were people who were trying to make the CBI take it over. So they wouldn't have to worry. I mean, so but anyway, having just said that, so there's even more corruption.
Even more corruption.
Right. So going forward, we do our investigation. I'm an expert in cellular technology. That's kind of my role. I can tell you from my standpoint, there is ample evidence that Evan Ebel did not act alone. And I know we're not here to discuss that, but trust me, or you don't have to trust me, I have the evidence that shows that Evan Ebel was communicating with other members of 211. There was three others that Terry Makita and John St. Augustine wanted to arrest. But then it came out about Sean May during all of our interviews that he was mistakenly assassinated, and it was supposed to be Dan May who was assassinated. Dan May freaked out. He added all the security to the DA's office, and he refused to prosecute any additional conspirators that we had evidence, solid evidence, a confession in one case. I mean, how can you have a confession and the DA says, don't worry about it, we'll just let it go? And that's what Chicken Little Dan May with the yellow streak down his back did to save his own neck. So, and going forward, then you have Terry Makita had his own issues and some things that had come up. He was term limited out. Then Bill Elder took over, and John St. Augustine and I, who, you know, are basically best friends, if you want to call it that, we had decided in the fall of that year that we were going to retire from the sheriff's office and go private. We thought that there was a market for what we knew and stuff, and it turned out to be very true. Our businesses were very successful. We were really getting a full steam, forward, a lot of business. And then what happened was, is Kirk Mitchell from the Denver Post asked if John St. Augustine and Terry Makita would give interviews concerning the third year anniversary of Tom Clements's murder. And they did. They gave this, and John St. Augustine was very clear that there was other conspirators that were involved. And of course, as a good reporter, Kirk Mitchell went with like, well, that's crazy. This is the first I've heard of this. So he calls Dan May and says, hey, do you have a response? And of course, Dan May is like, no, that's an ongoing investigation from years ago, which is, we're not doing anything. So he gets upset. And here's another thing that's really critical. When Bill Elder won election, he tried to make it sound as if Terry Makita was corrupt, which is not true. I worked for Terry Makita for 8 years. He was a great sheriff. I loved working for him. He was great.
He did have a little bit of a wandering eye.
Personal indiscretion. As a sheriff and as a supervisor, Terry Makita was probably one of the best sheriffs that El Paso County's ever had. And he did a great job with the Black Forest Fire and other stuff. But that's a separate issue.
Right.
So Bill Elder made a big thing in his campaign that he wanted to investigate Terry Makita. Dan May hates Terry Makita because he wouldn't support him in his election to the DA's office. So in the summer of 2000, I think it was 14, they investigate Terry Makita. And in September, CBI comes back and says, there's nothing there. There's no wrongdoing. This is the exact same thing they reinvestigate him for later. So what happens is right after this article comes out about Tom Clements, Dan May, his head explodes. He contacts Brockler in the 18th and says, hey, would you mind reinvestigating this? And oh, by the way, I want you to indict him. You know, I mean, because here's the situation. When you look at the timeline, you can't help. Common sense tells you there's problems here. So in March, the article comes out. In March, within days of the article coming out, Dan May contacts Brockler and says, can you help me out? In April, they convene a grand jury. Well, wow. How can you convene a grand jury in the next month? You got to collect evidence. They're investigating Terry Makita for the exact same thing that CBI said earlier, there's nothing there.
Right.
Well, of course, we all know if you stack the deck and you deal the cards like you do in a grand jury, you can indict anybody. Right. And during that grand jury, they actually contacted John St. Augustine. They subpoenaed him. And Mark Hurlburt, who ran the investigation for the 18th, told John St. Augustine's attorney, John Newsom, if John will come in and say that Terry Makita ordered him to arrest this person illegally, he'll be good to go. We won't charge him. And, you know, and they said, well, wait a minute, that just didn't happen. You want us to lie. And then his response was, well, if you change your mind and you're willing to do this, let us know. And then they indict John St. Augustine
with
absolutely no evidence. In fact, quite the contrary, there's evidence showing exculpatory evidence. They said that he ordered the false arrest of this person. But the detective in charge of the arrest said John wasn't even there. Had nothing to do with it. She told the grand jury this. But yet they load the deck and get the grand jury to indict. And it all boils down with this new, this is what's so interesting about this new. And I'm basically stating everything that's actually in this amended complaint that is public information that came out last week. So I'm not saying anything that's new, is there's emails that they found.
Right.
So the problem that they're having now at this point is they know for a fact that John St. Augustine key carded out of the parking structure. So it's not like he left the building and came back in. He left the building and didn't return for the rest of the day when the order was given to arrest this person. So they knew this in basically June of 2017. And that's when, well, actually, back up. I said that wrong. In June of 2016, John's attorney, who's probably one of the best criminal attorneys in Denver, Iris Etan, she said, basically, here, we have the evidence to prove that John Key carted out. So she provides the information, and you can see in one of the emails that's actually in this complaint, where Feverly, who's the other district attorney, says to the two CBI investigators, who are the ones that are being sued, which I think it's important you have their name, Ralph Gagliardi and Tim Martinez, both CBI agents, he's asking them, wait a minute, you know, there appears to be evidence here that he keycarded out of the building, and they knew that Gagliardi had told the grand jury that John keycarded into the meeting, right. Which is an absolute lie.
Yeah, exactly. That was, and I want to back up a second too, and then Mark will continue, just because people need to understand the significance of some of this. So Johnson Augustine sued. Now, a lot of the people, the DAs, for instance, have immunity, right?
Absolute immunity.
But the judge, and this is significant, the judge not only allowed the lawsuit to go forward against the one CBI agent who, as you said, we now know flat out, knowingly, deliberately lied to the grand jury, probably with the prosecutor's knowledge, but the judge last week saw enough other bad doings that he's allowing a second CBI agent to be sued. Now, we'll have to see what they say in depositions as to who was giving orders, but that just doesn't happen. And I think, Chuck, real quick before we get into that, you could comment. I mean, that says a lot, I think, about how the judge is viewing what's unfolding, don't you think?
Yeah, it's amazing that he's willing to expand it out, include a second defendant, which makes the case even a lot stronger. And indicates he thinks that there really were some shenanigans going on.
A conspiracy. I mean, if you have more than one person, there's a conspiracy there. Okay, and so then, Mark, then that's kind of clarified. So there are, because this came out, this is what's new in the filing, is email. Couple things. One, they relied on testimony in the grand jury from other deputies who they were presenting as saying, oh yeah, John St. Augustine was in the room. But we now know that many of those other law enforcement agents, that's not what they said at all. They're like, we don't remember. I don't think so. I mean, so they twisted and, as a lawsuit complaints, manipulated and maneuvered the other witnesses' testimony to completely twist it around from what they were actually saying,
and
right?
Correct me if I'm wrong, the person who ordered the arrest was an assistant DA who was at the meeting.
Right, and that's actually one of a big problematic issue as well, is the fact that in the room, this meeting, this infamous meeting that we're talking about, the arrest meeting or whatever, that John was not there. John St. Augustine was not in the room.
Probably not there.
His subordinates were there, and his supervisors, his bosses were there. And there was a DA. And anybody who knows law enforcement knows that if you're having a meeting to discuss whether if there's probable cause to make an arrest, and there's a district attorney in that room, they're going to say, yes, there's probable cause. Now, the DA can kind of hide and say, well, it's not up to me to arrest somebody. I'm just there providing guidance. Well, I get that. I can tell you, in every homicide meeting that I've ever been in, there's a DA there.
Right.
So whenever it's a high profile or a very serious case, the DA is part of the team. And just like in this case with Tom Clements, the DA said, we're not going to charge. So there was no arrests made. DA is the one calling the shots. Now, they can hide behind this cloak or whatever you want to say it, like in The Wizard of Oz, behind this curtain. But the bottom line is when a DA says you have enough probable cause, they're providing you with their expert opinion and you go make an arrest.
Right.
And that's what took place. And the grand jury knew this. Everyone admitted that she said there was probable cause.
And Sandra just got in late. So Sandra, this happened in El Paso County. That's where a lot of the corruption is. Then it moved up to the 18th Judicial District, and the case has actually been filed in federal court in Denver. Okay, so we got, on the one hand, the emails that show that very clearly now that they were manipulating the testimony of the other witnesses to make it appear.
Well, what's very important, these two CBI agents, it's obvious to me from reading through this that they're keeping evidence potentially, you know, from the grand jury, obviously. Well, they're lying to the grand jury,
right?
But they're not telling the district attorneys either at first. To me, it comes into, when does the culpability come in?
Right.
When you read through these emails, it almost sounds like at first the DAs are like, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah,
but you testified to the grand jury that he's in this room. And then now we find out from the defense attorney that the key card says he's out of the building. What the hell?
Right.
You know, and then they come back and start kind of twisting it. Now they're making excuses. Well, you know what? He could have called.
Maybe he called. And
even the DA said, so it has to do, when does the culpability come into play? So when the initial arrest is made, It's clear to me there's no doubt that the two CBI agents are colluding. And really one of the keys is what you read in the complaint. They do some initial interviews with a couple deputies at the sheriff's office, and they ask them, hey, why is John making these negative statements about the Tom Clements homicide? Well, this investigation has nothing to do with Tom Clements. Right. So they're kind of setting the table from the standpoint of, hey, this is all retribution because they spoke out against the team. And one thing that's kind of important to know about law enforcement, obviously I'm very pro law enforcement. I was a cop for 17 years, but there's that whole team spirit. And I think Chuck's kind of hit on this before in other conversations to where they protect each other. They all feel like, you know, law enforcement is a family. We're a team. Right. Now I've definitely said law enforcement is a team sport. There's no doubt about that, but sometimes you get this over urgency that, you know, it's a family. Since I've gone private and I've testified for defense and prosecution since I've gone into this, I've had a lot of people that won't even talk to me from law enforcement, from DA's offices that won't be seen with me. I had, when I retired and they knew that I was going to go work for some defense attorneys, they wouldn't do a conference that we had up in Keystone with me because I left the family and I was a traitor. Wow. So I get the feeling that, and this is just my opinion, that these two CBI agents, not only did they have already probably getting this hatred from above because John and Terry Makita pissed them off over the Tom Clements murder investigation, but they feel like that they, in talking to the media, that John somehow was a traitor. And so they were targeting him to go after him. There's no doubt in my mind.
Here's the thing. Number one, they spend way more time and energy prosecuting John St. Augustine for a non-crime, not only a non-crime, but a crime that he couldn't have even committed.
He wasn't even there.
Than they ever spent looking at the Tom Clements murder case. I mean, to me, it's like ridiculous.
Exactly.
They're half as much about that.
In talking briefly to George Bockler about the case, as he saw it, whoever the woman was they charged, Paula Pressley, you know, he was angry that they didn't charge Paula Pressley first and then go up to John St. Augustine and then go up to Terry Makita, that was the sin that was done. Instead, they went after Makita, he got off, and so then everybody else did too. The mere fact that John St. Augustine was a totally innocent person never really figures into
things. But here's, and you bring up a great point. You know, the charges before the game was because Terry Makita is the only one who went to trial. In fact, he went twice and hung the jury both times. Right before he went to trial for the first time, they dropped all the charges based on this false, the whole thing against John St. Augustine, that supposedly he was the intermediary between Terry Makita, you know, to do this illegal arrest. They dropped all the charges against Makita in June. I believe it was in June, but they wouldn't drop the charges against St. Augustine for another 4 or 5 months later. Oh, by the way, 2 weeks before he went to trial. Right. So they knew, and this is where I was talking about this culpability. At first, there's no doubt the CBI agents knew what they were doing. I mean, they were doing a malicious, they were setting up John St. Augustine. Then there's the other culpability of Mark Hurlburt and Feverly, the two district attorneys. And oh, by the way, Feverly quit unexpectedly 2 weeks before Terry Makita's trial. Wonder why, because I don't think you wanted any part of this. They have the culpability from the time, and these emails completely lay it out. They knew at a certain time that John wasn't there. They knew the evidence showed he wasn't there, but they let him stay under indictment for a year, and it ruined his life. This is one of the critical points in this whole, what are the damages? I've had a very successful career since I left the sheriff's office. And John was right there with me. We were doing all kinds of business. And then I was having attorneys tell me, yeah, you can come out and deliver the training, but John can't.
Right. Because he's been charged.
Because he's under indictment. John lost all kinds of opportunities. And you can't just rebuild that. As soon as, like they always say, they indict you on the first page and then they cut you loose on the 30th page or the back page. And so everyone, and how much is it worth to have your mugshot on the internet forever, which John has now because of what they did to them. So Go ahead.
And I was going to say, and I think, again, just to emphasize to folks, so, and they did this in part because they didn't like El Paso County. They didn't like Terry Makeda. They did it in part because John St. Augustine was simply telling the truth about
the wouldn't lie for
murder case. And he wouldn't lie for them about Terry Makeda, where they flat out said, if you change your mind, it's like, how do you change your mind about the evidence? The evidence is like, no, we didn't do this, which they later acknowledged when they dropped the charges. But what they did, these new emails that have been released show that, again, two things. Number one, they manipulated the other witnesses' testimony to completely give the wrong impression. The other witnesses were saying John St. Augustine wasn't there. They made it appear he was. Then they made it appear, well, they just flat out lied about the fact that he had key carded into this meeting when they knew. And then the DA, when they knew he had left the building even. And then the DA in the emails, rather than say, guys, we got a problem here. We can't put him in. I mean, it'd be like I'm accused of a crime and all of the evidence shows I'm in another state at the time, right? And instead they're like, well, maybe she teleported through an alien machine or something and came back. But they're saying, well, maybe he called, or maybe he went for a smoke break with somebody else. Because they even clarified that and found out, no, that didn't happen. There was no other explanation. They knew 100% knew that they were lying about his presence.
You know what they never talk about in any of these emails, which is my big pet peeve against investigations in district attorney's offices, is they never talk about, hey, guys, let's get to the truth.
Right.
I mean, you don't see any email saying, hey, guys, let's get to the truth. You know, this guy could be falsely accused. You know, my God, let's get this worked out and get him out of indictment. If this is true, you know, what are we doing? They're coming up with excuses. Like you said, you know, is there any spaceships that could have landed on the roof?
Right.
You know, because then they start talking about maybe he called someone. You know that before they indicted him, they never checked his phone records to see who he called or anything. So it's kind of like, you know, it's you're playing poker and you say, hey, I'm all in. Okay, deal the cards. You know, they put all their chips in the middle of the table saying we're going to indict John St. Augustine. They don't even know what the cards are yet.
Right.
And then they lie.
Well, then you get to the point where they're kind of go, well, can he plead guilty to jaywalking?
Right.
That's correct.
And Iris says, no. And so finally, they come to the judge in the trial and they said, we're going to dismiss it because this other guy used the N-word. It was all garbage.
Which had nothing
you know
to
what was
that?
So good about that? I was in the courtroom when that happened, supporting John through this whole process. And obviously I still support him. Iris Etan, she was just awesome. She unloaded and she said, when Hurlburt stepped said, hey, we'd like to do a motion to dismiss, you know, things have changed. Some additional evidence has come in. She stood up and basically called him a flat out liar to his face and said, you tell me right now, what's the new evidence that you're talking about? Right. What is this new evidence that just came up that she goes, it doesn't exist and you're a liar.
Wow.
And so she was awesome through the whole process because she knew.
Here's the best part. So, you know, unlike in the case with General Flynn, they want it dismissed, so they dismiss it. But just like with General Flynn in some ways, the judge then seals all the evidence in the case. That is just rotten.
So, well, the judge is covering for the rotten DA.
Yeah, and the whole system stinks, and we're gonna, in fact, cover it up. So who was the judge?
You know, I don't want to say anything because I may get it wrong. And if I say the wrong judge, I would feel bad about that.
Let me ask you this, Mark.
So covers everything up because he or she knows it's rotten and stinks. And if the public got a hold of it, they meant not think well of the judicial system or the criminal justice system, and they shouldn't. As far as I know, it's still sealed.
Right. Well, yes. Well, I mean, I don't know for sure because I'm not in on it, you know, and I have to admit, before John started this lawsuit, obviously him and I were talking all the time, you know, because I'm trying to help him out and all kinds of stuff. Once the lawsuit started, we really couldn't talk about a lot of this stuff.
Right.
So I have to wait until
you're,
I can get
well, you're a witness and stuff. Yeah.
You know,
well,
things like that. But go ahead.
My thing is, okay, so we know, and this is, it's very interesting, everybody listening, that the judge, a federal judge who is hearing all of this coming out now, has allowed the case to go forward against not one, but two CBI agents. Now, it can't go forward against the DAs because they have absolute immunity. But here's my question, Mark.
Which is, one, sad.
Right.
Two, this judge could have found that they engaged as part of the
conspiracy.
Well, no, as part of the charging decisions and part of the enforcement and investigation, because the DAs don't have absolute immunity if they in part of the investigation.
Maybe
he's not going to let it, because let's face what the thing is. Judges often are DAs.
They are
very seldom former police officers. Therefore, they understand DAs are crooked, and they like it that way. And so they want to keep them from criticism.
Crooked.
Yeah.
Well, because this goes to my question, Mark. And like I said, this is a little bit of speculation, so this is not coming from the lawsuit. I know the CBI didn't really like, you know, El Paso County and maybe not Terry Makita and John St. Augustine, but I have a hard time imagining that two rogue CBI agents on their own came up with this conspiracy to say, I know that, I hate that John St. Augustine, let's just get him and lie about it and convince the DA to charge. I truly suspect that there was conversations between the El Paso County DA and the El Paso County Sheriff Elder and May and what was ever going on at the 18th Judicial District, and they just said, get him. And we don't care what you have to do to get them. We don't care how you get them. Just get them. And that proceeded to unfold. I mean, you tell me, I just don't see, I cover a lot of cops and CBI agents, and I just don't see them without somebody else telling them to do that, or at least, you know, going along with it, risking their entire careers on this.
Right. So one of the things that's interesting to understand is when CBI was asked to come down and head up or help with this investigation with Mark Hurlburt and Feverly, they gave them offices at the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. And I have from an inside source in the office that the undersheriff, Joe Breister, who I think is actually the mastermind behind all of this, which is my personal opinion, he met with them every day. So the undersheriff was basically overseeing the investigation, and CBI agents were briefing him on a daily basis. And also one of the key points, and I think Mark Hurlburt really screwed up. After the first trial, he told the media, set up over here, because after we get the guilty on Makita, I'm going to give this big press conference. Well, then he got not guilties on most of it and some hung. So he snuck out the back of the courtroom or of the courthouse. And one reporter got him. And got him to say something. And what he said, and this is all public information. You can go out and watch this today if you can go find this old recording. He basically says, yeah, obviously I'm disappointed in the results, but I would like to thank the El Paso County Sheriff's Office for everything they did in this investigation.
And helping.
It's like, wait a minute, you idiot.
Right.
You know, you kind of gave up the secret there, because they weren't supposed to have anything to do with it. This was supposed to be an independent investigation.
Right.
But he knew that there was people in the sheriff's office, high level, that were basically running this investigation, this is my opinion, based on some sources that I have inside the sheriff's office who told me this stuff, saying this kind of stuff.
Well, I think somebody's texting you, your house is about to blow up. CBI agents are at the door.
We understand this too. These are not just low-level CBI agents.
Right.
These are agents in charge.
Right.
So these are high level. These are like senior detectives in most agents, or maybe even like sergeants or something. So, you know, I don't know. To be honest with you, I hate, you know, because I'm all about the facts. As a retired detective, to me, it's all about the facts and the truth. And I can't prove what's in the minds of these CBI agents.
Right.
I know what they did was corrupt. I know that they withheld information. I know they targeted John St. Augustine, and they did whatever they could to make sure that he got indicted for a year and a half. And then finally, you know, as it got close to trial, the DAs showed a little sanity in saying,
we can't prove this.
We're out. We know we're going to get our asses handed to us. Well, I guess I probably shouldn't be saying that, but they knew that this was going to go bad. And you have to suspect that these two CBI agents, like you said, maybe at first, you know, they might have been doing this on their own. I mean, the questions that they're asking people don't make sense, but we don't know. I mean, I don't know for sure, I know Hurlburt should be disbarred.
It's probably the one and only time they try to indict and convict an innocent person. Now, time in each of their 20-year career that they were corrupt. All other times they were...
True and blue. And that's why they need to get rid of absolute immunity. There should be such thing as absolute immunity. I know we could have a conversation, and Chuck, I think we'd actually probably be on the opposite sides of the table on qualified immunity. But I think maybe we should have something.
I agree with qualified immunity. I mean, and those, I don't think DA should just be sued by anyone under any circumstances. I think that it does have to reach a bar, and it does have to be outrageous conduct. But when it is outrageous conduct, and so that the qualified immunity is no longer applicable. I know down at the state legislature, I talked to various people, and they tried to get a bill through this year to get rid of qualified immunity for DAs, and I don't know where that stands.
I want to just bring some, Sandra, I think, came in a little bit late. So she is saying, didn't the 211 crew kill an attorney with the last name May when it's supposed to be Dan May that was supposed to be targeted? Yes, Sandra, yes. And Hickenlooper was involved. And I think it goes—
Well, it's interesting they killed him. They killed him because Dan May worked in the 18th Judicial District. They thought they crooked they lied, cheated, and crooked the indictments of
against
the fellow
gang,
members. They, you know, if the Serenios had, you know, they weren't mad if you kind of got them
fairly,
but they felt that, and I have a feeling they were probably right.
Well,
they crooked that one too.
But I think underlying all of this, though, Sandra, you're right, is there is this, because they know, I think, that they're going to have cover from the highest level. They've got cover from the governor on this, then Governor Hickenlooper. They've got cover from John Southers, who was involved in all of this too. I mean, they've got cover from the highest levels of government in Colorado. Everybody wants everyone to shut up about the Tom Clements murder case. And we're the only people still won't shut up. I guess Chris Osher, he's doing a great job down at the Colorado Springs Gazette. I think he's so... If we'll have to stay in touch.
Chris Osher has done a tremendous job.
But I think, though, let me just ask you this. I mean, Chuck has always, you know, believed the prosecutors were corrupt. I admit it's becoming harder and harder for me to stand against.
Just say
it.
Chuck was right again.
I mean, this case, the outrageousness, and like you said, it's hard to imagine that this was just the first time they took these kind of actions. I mean, they don't even try to hide it.
I think this has kind of been my issue, you know, because they say that I've switched teams, which I don't think I have. My team's always been the truth. As an expert witness in cellular technology and cell phone records, I just say, here's what the records say. What I found, you know, it's kind of like you don't want to see, they always say in a restaurant, you don't want to see how the sausage is made.
Right.
You know, I was a cop for 17 years, and I've seen some after long periods of time that definitely believe the end justifies the means. Yeah. I know this guy's guilty, so therefore I'm only going to look at the evidence, you know, and I'm going to ignore anything that might be exculpatory. Now in John's case, I mean, they just made stuff up. I mean, it's one thing if it's like, hey, okay, I might have been the driver of, you know, or something, but he wasn't even there. But I think they get into this mentality of they lose what is the key point of being in law enforcement or the judicial system, which is to seek the truth.
Right.
And I think you found with Dan May, Hurlburt, where they had an ends to a means. I know why Dan May did this. He wanted him to be quiet because he didn't want this coming out about Sean May.
Right.
You know, he didn't want everyone to know that he was a big chicken.
Right.
So I get it. But Hurlburt should have known better. And like you said, Chuck, you can't think that all of a sudden something clicked and he woke up one morning and said, hey, I think I'll be corrupt from now on.
Right.
You know? Right. And so you have to wonder about previous cases.
And as Chuck pointed out too, and I like George Brockler, but, and here's the but, you got to wonder why when we've talked to him about this, his answer is like, I wasn't involved there and Robert's gone. I would hope that somebody like George Brockler, who was himself sort of worried about the 211 crew, by the way, at the very beginning, he had protection when all of this happened. You would hope that he would have said something like, you know, gall, guys, we probably need to get to the bottom of this. Maybe I need to have my own guy. I mean, but instead he was, you know, he was like, hey, I just wasn't there. And to me, it's like, that's not a good enough answer. I'm sorry. The fact, I wasn't
plausible
there.
Plausible denial.
Like, yeah. And I
just didn't know.
What's the truth?
If you want to see a dramatic version of exactly what we're talking about, you do have to see Touch of Evil, because it's just about a corrupt police officer and a DA and everyone else that really started out wanting to do right. But by the end of his life, he did get ends justify the means. And
except
he was right. The guy was guilty. And I'm like,
that's the underlying political corruption in this case, though. I can, although it's not right. It's one thing to say the end justifies the means. If you've got a bad guy and you're trying to take them off the streets. The only thing they were trying to do here was give, I think, political cover to people like John Hickenlooper and Dan May. I mean, there's no bad guy. The only, the underlying corruption in this case is, to me, what is the most astonishing. The whole thing is to make people like John St. Augustine, people like Kurt Mitchell, people like us, people like you, quit talking about, well, who the heck killed these people? Mm-hmm. Then they don't care about that, because it, for all of them, from John Southers to John Hickenlooper, all of these people have their own reasons why it makes them look bad, the truth. And so it's just to give cover to political and political operatives.
So
and,
what's happening with the sheriff's election now?
Well, Bill Elder's in his second term. And what I find is so interesting is, you know, all the political rumors going around was that he was going to run for county commissioner afterwards. Well, that's over with. There's this really awesome website out there that has just laid all of his corruption out.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so his political career is over. So what he's done is he's bought a house in Arizona, and he's commuting. He's telecommuting as sheriff
and
for
voting.
His last year.
He's voting and, too. Yeah.
So, my understanding is that he's, and again, this is my opinion, and this is what people are telling me from inside the sheriff's office. He's basically checked out at this point. He knows that he's been called out for being corrupt. And there's so many other things that have happened.
Yeah,
this not is- just this. There's been so many bad things that have happened. Just to give one thing to really kind of sums up his entire administration. Before Terry Makita left, he got a tax initiative passed to put more boots on the ground. And Terry Makita did a great job of putting more deputies on the street using this special money. Well, when Bill Elder took off, he diverted all those funds to other places. And there's less deputies in patrol right now than when Bill Elder took office. And that's the same for the jail. So they're getting a few extra $1 million a year that was specifically earmarked for more deputies on the street and in the jail. And there's less now than when Bill Elder took office. That is the definition of corruption.
Well, and now with back to the case, the court case, because it's going forward now, and right. Actually hopefully things start moving faster.
Do you have a trial date yet?
Next February is my understanding.
Okay. So sooner or later, and Chuck and I were talking about this, sooner or later, the two CBI agents, because this is a civil case, right?
Yes.
Not a criminal case.
Yes, that is correct.
Deposed. And I was saying to Chuck, I think it'd be really, really interesting to hear what they have to say to see if they give up, because I think it goes a little bit further than them. But you were saying that it may not be that easy. And I said, can you take the fifth in a civil case?
Of course you can. Of course you can all the time. Unless you're granted immunity, which they won't grant to them, they will claim the Fifth Amendment. That'll screw the cities involved, or the people, you know, the liability, because they're not going to pay for it itself. But if they do not want to be having to admit to crimes, because then somebody could come back and indict them. So if you were representing those guys, you just Fifth Amendment, shut up.
Go
shut
live
up.
In Arizona.
And the thing that gets me is because, you know, I'm really not involved. You know, I don't have a horse in the race. I really want to see this go to trial.
Yes.
I will take that week off. I'll take all my vacation. Well, I work for myself now. I can give myself vacation. But I will be up in that courtroom every day taking notes.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll join you.
So much, because all these other players, even though those two are the only two that the case is against, they're the defendants, they're allowing all these other players to get on the stand. Yeah. I want to see them raise their right hand and all start throwing each other under the bus.
That exactly. It's going to be a bus massacre. I mean,
right. Cause we'll never know what was said in the depositions.
Right.
You know, they've got to have a trial, and I want to see, you know, just like in some of these movies where the jury says, "Hey, Your Honor, can we give him more money than he's asking for?" You know, because that's really how this is going to play out.
You have to get, and Sandra's saying, I'd rather be sitting in on the depositions. They're better than the trial witnesses. That's true.
That is true.
I think that hopefully, and you know, John St. Augustine's got to do what he's got to do. But as you said, the other thing that is so wrong about this is they destroyed his life. They didn't care. They knew they were lying. They knew that they had no reason to indict him. Not even no reason. They knew they were falsely and wrongly indicting him. Yep. Worse than no reason. They destroyed his life, and they just didn't care.
Right. I mean, they did it for their own personal vindictiveness. And the real players who caused all this aren't the two. I mean, well, I don't know for sure. I mean, I know the two CBI agents, from everything that I'm reading, if it's true, they obviously did a lot of stuff, a malicious prosecution, and there's no doubt. I just think that also there's other players behind the scenes, and they've basically gotten away with this. And but you know, what's important is they have been called out. Everybody knows about the true, you know, Sheriff Bill Elder. They know how corrupt he is. They know the stuff that he's done. And so that's cool too. I'm glad that all that information is out. But down in El Paso County, which is the county I'm in, they're probably going to be knocking at my door here before I can even finish. They need to clean house. They need, you know, I'm a lifelong Republican, and I hold fellow Republicans at a higher standard than I would Democrats, because we're supposed to be known for better, you know, for having integrity. And the El Paso County Republican Party down here, I don't know what they're doing, but they need to completely clean house.
Yep.
Well, yeah, because I'm down in El Paso County for politics a lot. And you've got
some new people.
You've got the establishment ones, which are people like Wayne Williams and his wife Holly Williams and really
politicians.
Well, the worst kind of politicians. I mean, Southers just jumped on board the Democrat incredible raping of fees,
the transportation,
$1.7 billion dollars, yeah. And that's all Southers. They get, oh, we have Republican support. We've got Southers as well as Kevin Priola. You've got the grassroots people, which are great people.
Vicky Tompkins
and all those. So I don't know.
There's hope for you.
Well, maybe. I don't know. Who's running for mayor, do you know?
I have no idea. You know what, Chuck, and I hate to admit this, I've kind of just given up on politics down here.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean...
Well, we got to let you go, Mark. For our audience, we will stay on this because there are interesting developments in this case constantly. So I want to thank you for your time and for the work that you're doing on that. And I'm sure
we'll let us know the trial date because we'll be joining you. We'll be giving vacation to ourselves.
That's right. We'll all be on vacation.
Just make sure you guys will bail me out when they come for me down
here. All right.
All right. We'll do it.
All right.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Thank you.
Talk to you later.
Yes, Sandra is like El Paso needs to get John Southers out. You know, we only have a few minutes left, 3 minutes left. So, Chuck, I wanted to say one other thing, talking about how idiot people are. This is a very funny story. Well, funny, sad story in Westford today about a place called Pong Island. Apparently some guy in Denver during sort of that, as the weather started getting warmer, I mean, the whole COVID thing was locked down and nothing was open, and he had to wear masks, put a ping pong table, took it from his house and put a ping pong table in like a traffic island, right? Mm-hmm. And then put out a bunch of paddles and stuff. And it became like this very cool neighborhood hangout. Everybody, people constantly playing ping pong there, right? Just friendly, people sharing paddles. It was just people having fun, right? Kind of like what you should do at a park. Well, the city of Denver came out there, saw that there was a ping pong table because it's a little island that the city of Denver owns, and they removed it.
Well,
they
told the poor guy didn't get arrested and incarcerated. Yeah.
And some of the
I mean, the least he could have done is defecate down.
Well, that's what some of the comments were saying, that if he had maybe made it. So wait, so we can't have a ping pong table where kids are playing bothering anybody. Because when I say traffic island, the balls weren't going to traffic. It was just a little space of land. But some of the comments are, but if he had put a homeless encampment there and used needles and defecated there and was dealing drugs and prostitution out of that, then that would be okay.
That's
city
right.
of Denver, and the police wouldn't even talk to him about it. But no, you put a ping pong table up and you have kids playing and people enjoying.
Oh, that's
terrible. Well, we cannot
do that.
Thank
God they stopped that down in Denver. That's right. Standard.
It's like, it's like,
we gotta go, Julie.
All right, hey, everybody
take care.
Let me give our plug for chuckandjulie.com.
Okay.
I know I'd like to have you guys listen to us if you can on YouTube. Those of you who listen on YouTube, you can go to Chuck and Julie, the Chuck and Julie Show at YouTube or on Podbean. Love to have you subscribe and follow us. And you can catch all of our shows at chuckandjulie.com. Thank you to Thomas and all the great folks at BBS.
Yeah. And thanks very much to our guest. Appreciate it taking the time.
All right. We'll see you all on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Bye.